Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Also, while you're over there, you can go to the events page, check out all the events. We got speakers going out to all kinds of things, and one of the things you'll see us going out to is city events. Guys, we're going to be in Houston, and we're going to be in Las Vegas. Come hang out with us in February and March. We'd love to see you there. Those events are free. All the information is on the events page. And, you know, you just sign up. We need you to sign up so we know how many people to expect, but that's all it is. Just you signing up and then coming and getting all the stuff for free. Chad, when this releases, me and you are going to be in San Diego.
Yeah, I know. It's like right down to the wire.
I know, man. It is coming upon us. We're recording this a little earlier than we usually do so we can release it on time. And if you listen to it when it first comes out, Here We Still Stand will be on the verge of launching. It'll be just later that day. If you are there, you're probably not listening to this. You're probably doing all kinds of other things. But if you are listening to this and you're not there and you're feeling kind of this FOMO creep up, you can stave off a little bit of that by getting over there and watching the live stream. So go over to 1517, click around. You can find the live stream, and you can watch the sessions. You can watch all the talks. You can watch my talk on Thursday night. You can watch Chad's devotions on Friday and Saturday morning. You can watch all of it, and we'd love for you to do it. It's also free, so go over there and check that out. I'll put a link to that live stream in the show notes. All right, Chad. So Jericho has been overthrown, and what do we got going on now? I mean, it's probably just smooth sailing now, right?
I mean, it's just like all downhill. I mean, it's no problem whatsoever.
I'm trying to figure out what the rest of this book is about, considering that everything's done, I guess.
It's all sweetness and light. That's all it is. Oh. Yeah,
just poetry. Israel. Huh?
Yeah, just poetry. Israel has finally gotten past sin, and they're totally holy. Completely devoted to the Lord.
Well, I figure they go to the promised land and then the sin thing is just done.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, no Selma Yusufzefikator going on here. They're just all justified and righteous, except for a little problem, a little bump in the road that we've got here in chapter 7. Actually, chapter 7 and 8, I don't know if we're going to get to all of 8 today or not, but it's all one unit. And it's about our friend Achan, who is going to cause some problems. Is going to cause some achor.
Yeah,
is the word play there in Hebrew. So yeah, it's not a repeat of Jericho. Let's put it that way.
So he's not going to do something that he was explicitly told not to do, is he?
Oh no, that would never happen amongst the Israelites, or of course among Christians either. Yeah, this is one of those stories that I appreciate for a number of reasons, only because it pulls together a whole lot of biblical themes that are expanded upon in other places. We've got, for instance, we've got coveting going on. In fact, the word that's used in the Ten Commandments for not to covet is used here as well. The verb is chamad, and I'll talk a little bit more about its background once we get to that verse. So, but you've got the theme of coveting, which of course is made explicit in the Ten Commandments and is played out here in narrative style in the case of Achan. You also have a pretty major theological theme that's illustrated here, and that is of corporate personality or corporate responsibility. Because as it turns out, one guy sinned. And yet that one sin of one particular guy had corporate consequences. And we see that also played out in lots of other places in the Old Testament. Of course, the one that at least immediately jumps to my mind goes all the way back to Genesis in the sin of Adam. But there's other instances of this as well. But that's another one of those themes here. That comes out, and one more or two more actually, one more that is explicit here, is the idea that we've seen already multiple times in Joshua, and that is that the only way the Israelites are going to win is because God's on their side. They don't have superior military technology. They don't have superior military experience. All they have is the Lord on their side, the one fighting for them, the one who is giving them the victory. And as we see here, even though they go up against a city that is not as well defended as Jericho, a city that's not as big as Jericho, they get beat up. They get defeated. They lose men. So, and the reason is, of course, it's because the Lord is not fighting for them. So we see that also illustrated here. And then one more thing before we actually get to the text itself, and this is going to come up at the end. I want to save that for the end. But in this chapter, it's all about a lot of negatives. You got rebellion, you got sin, you've got guilt, you've got punishment, you've got death. And it ends with a reference to the Valley of Achor, which means the Valley of Trouble. In the midst of all of this negativity, you wouldn't think that there'd be any hint whatsoever of grace or gospel, but actually there is. And I want to show you that once we get to the end by jumping from Joshua to the book of Hosea, chapter 2, where there is like 700 years after all this happens, Hosea references this particular incident, and he twists it around as a prophecy of what the Messiah is going to do when he comes. So a lot of good stuff to get to. And I guess we better get to it.
Let's do it, man. Let's get right in it.
So let me read the first five verses, and that'll set the scene for us. It says, "But the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban." That's the cherem that we talked about last time. "For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, 'Go up and spy out the land.' So the men went up and spied out Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said to him, 'Don't let all the people go up. Only about 2,000 or 3,000 men need to go up to Ai. Don't make all the people toil up there, because they are few.' So about 3,000 men from the people went up there, but they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai struck down about 36 of their men and pursued them from the gate as far as Shevarim and struck them down on the descent. So the hearts of the people melted and became as water." All right. So what's happening here, just as far as the structure itself goes, is kind of interesting, because we, as the readers of this story, already in verse one, know what the problem is. So it's like the storyteller has brought us into the story, and he's revealing more to us than was known by Joshua and the rest of the Israelites. So he's setting up the story for us by already telling us what the problem is. Of course, the Bible doesn't always do this. Sometimes it kind of gives us this heads up before the story is actually told as to what the problem is. Sometimes it saves it for the end and just kind of lets the story unfold and you figure out what's wrong as you're reading the story. But in this case, already in verse one, we're told what the issue is. So we're privy to the problem before Joshua and the Israelites are. So we have this perspective that we're entering into the story with already. So we know what the problem is, and we're going to figure out what the solution is as we go on.
There's two things that are interesting about those first verses. In the ESV, it translates that first verse as, "But the people of Israel broke faith," which I think is an interesting term. It's not something that you see a lot. It's maybe a term that we understand, but it's not a term you see here a lot in the Bible. So they broke faith with God. We know what this is, you know. So we expect people to act in good faith, or if we make a commitment to someone or a promise, and they've broken that. The agreement is damaged, so they have broken faith with God, which also means that they've ceased to trust God, because this is what faith is trust. And so they've broken trust with him.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting that what this results in, of course, we see is that things do not go well in this battle that even Joshua thinks is not going to be a big deal. And then when you've broken faith with God, when you no longer are trusting God, you might think, well, is it really that they're not trusting God, or is it just that they did the thing that they weren't supposed to do? Well, in doing the thing that they weren't supposed to do, they in this case, keeping some of these material things, it is an explicit way of saying to God that I don't trust you to give me the things I need. I need these things too. Like these things that if I accumulate these things to myself, these things will help me get other things I need. I mean, you accumulate these riches to yourself, so presumably you can have more possessions or more whatever it is. And so you are then not depending on God to provide for you. And all of this results in this reversal. And it's interesting that it uses this term at the end of this, that their hearts melted, which is something that we heard previous was like the people of Jericho, that you know, Rahab said that the people's hearts had melted, and then you know, in the after the battle or when they're marching and going across the sea and all these things, we see over and over again that the people's hearts had melted, and this switches, and so you break faith with God, and then it's not your enemy's hearts who are melting, it's yours as your enemies are trampling all over you.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, the tables have completely turned. And I checked this exact same expression that we find in chapter 2 and in chapter 5, both in translation as well as in the original. And another thing that just kind of accents how much the tables have turned is this metaphor that you see at the end of verse 5, not just that their hearts melted, but became as water. Mm-hmm. This is the only place in the Old Testament where that particular analogy occurs. It's pushing the envelope even further.
Yeah, when you hear something melted, like a term that you hear a lot, it's like melted like wax. This mm-hmm. is telling you that their hearts were much thinner than that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that, I wasn't aware of the ESV translation. I'm working with New American Standard on this, but I like the translation of broke faith. In the Hebrew, what you often have is you'll have a noun and a verb that are paired together that are basically the same word, except one is a noun form, one is a verbal form. So literally in the Hebrew, it would be something like the Israelites acted unfaithfully by doing unfaithfulness, right. Something like that anyway. So you have a repetition of the verb and then the cognate noun. But in English, of course, that sounds very weird and very wooden to us. But broke faith, I think, captures it. I mean, that yeah. really is the essence of what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, it seems what God is upset about here is that he's made this all pretty easy. I mean, it's, I'm going to take care of everything. Just don't do these things. It's very simple. I mean, I'm going to give you the victory. I'm going to march around. You're going to march around stuff. I'm going to have walls fall down. Israel may have not lost one single guy in this battle.
Yeah, we're not told about any deaths, right?
Yeah, none.
On the part of the Israelites.
None. No yeah. losses, right? God is like giving you a complete victory. And all he wants you to do is not do something.
Yeah, right.
And you can't not do that thing. And this is why like faith is broken. But look what I've done. I mean, you've marched across the Jordan, and we did this whole thing with the marching around the walls. Everything came down. You had this complete victory. Like, how can you not trust me when I say, don't do this thing? And then that's the one thing that you go and do. Yeah. And what this also shows you is that it does tell you that there's this one guy who's doing this thing, a stark picture of, this sin wouldn't affect anyone but me. Like, it's just me. Mm-hmm. I'm the only one who's really disobeying God here, which, of course, is always a lie. I will tell you from experience that your sin never just affects you.
Yeah, never. I mean, that is one of the lies. It's like we constantly tell ourselves, and even though we know it's not true, we still believe it. I'm going to do this and it's only going to affect me, but that's not the way. You can't like put boundaries around sin and like say, okay, this is just going to affect me. No, because it leaks out, always does. And even if it doesn't, like in a way that you can tell, it affects you and your interactions with other people. So yeah, sin is always corporate in that way and never individual. And, you know, we see that. I was going to point this out. Just slipped my mind. But we see that already in the opening words of the chapter. Because notice the way, I was going to look at it here in the Hebrew because I forgot to check this before we started. Well, yeah, but in the English translation, anyway, it starts out, but the sons of Israel.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't say, but Achan did.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we see Well, we see it there in verse 1. If you skip ahead to verse 11, this is God speaking now. And he says, Israel has sinned. And then it goes on to say, they have taken some of the things under the ban, and they have put them among their own things. So that's one of the ways in which we see this language of corporate responsibility or corporate personality here, that even though it's one guy, it affects the whole body of Israel. I mean, it really is, as I made reference earlier, it really is a continuation of something that begins Genesis 3 and continues on. And, you know, we see this. This isn't just kind of a biblical truth. If you stop to think about just your own life, your family's life, or national life, a church life, we can come up with example after example of how one person's wrongdoing affects a whole family or a whole city or sometimes a whole nation. That is the way that sin works. It spreads out to either a small group of people or sometimes to a very large group of people. So this theme of corporate responsibility and the corporate nature of sin is throughout the scriptures, but we see it in our own lives. I mean, the example that always comes to my mind, and maybe it's because my Monday through Friday job is being a truck driver, but all of us have seen this. You're out on the road, and especially if you live in a city like I do in San Antonio, one guy screws up on the road. Maybe he's texting, maybe whatever happens with his vehicle. And if it's bad enough, thousands of people are affected by that one decision on the road. You know, it's backed up for who knows how long because of the mistake that one person made. So we see that in cases like that, and we see it on the moral or the theological level all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we see what's happening here in these opening verses, and let's go on and see what happens after that. This, because the section that follows it, I mean, even though it's serious, it's also kind of humorous too when you look at how Joshua reacts, and especially how God reacts to Joshua's reaction. So I'm going to read with verses 6 and following. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until the evening, both he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord God, why did you ever bring this people over the Jordan, only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan." Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? "O Lord, what can I say, since Israel has turned their back before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and they will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name?" Well, I'm going to stop there before we get to God's response. I forget where I was at. I was speaking somewhere and talking about various illustrations of people from the Old Testament who have messed up in big ways. You know, I was talking about Noah and his drunkenness, and Abraham lying about Sarah, and David with his adultery, or to whatever you call it, and murder, and all these other illustrations. And someone asked me, "What about Joshua? You know, Joshua seems to come out with a pretty good record. I mean, he didn't really ever mess up." And I think here is a good illustration of the fact that, yeah, Joshua might not have quite as long of a rap sheet as some of these other folks in the Old Testament, but here we've already encountered one situation with him back in the Torah with his dispute with Moses about who should be receiving the Spirit and prophesying. But this is a classic example of Joshua basically being just like the murmuring and complaining Israelites all the way back at the Red Sea, right? I mean, that was the first thing that leapt to my mind as soon as I heard his words here. Why did you deliver us? Why did you ever bring us over the Jordan? If only we'd been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan. That's classic Israelite there.
Yeah, I mean, as if God had ever told them that they should be content to dwell there, that they weren't content to dwell there because that's not what God had promised.
Yeah. I mean, way back at Exodus 15, the Israelites were saying, oh, that we had just stayed in Egypt.
Yeah.
Right? Why'd you ever bring us out of the land of Egypt only to deliver us into the grave?
Every time these guys pass through a body of water, they start talking about how they should have stayed on the other side of the water.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's just the way the Israelites have been. And so Joshua does not come out as some sort of pure specimen of righteousness here, because he's acting like a typical Israelite, basically blaming God for what just happened. And as we'll see in just a second, when God addresses him, he realizes that God's going to make him realize that he's not to blame. It's rather the Israelites who are to blame. But you notice the extent to which Joshua goes to illustrate just how upset he is. I mean, you can kind of see this on a psychological level too, because so far everything has been going according to plan. He was selected to replace Moses. God actually appears to him as the commander of the armies and puts a stamp of approval on Joshua. When they cross the Jordan, God says, now I'm going to show Israel that basically I'm with you, just like I had been with Moses. So this is one of these examples of just how devastating it can be when everything seems to be going your way, and you just have a positive outcome, victory after victory, and all of a sudden it feels like just the rug has been pulled out from underneath your feet. It's devastating to Joshua because it's so shocking. There was nothing that, as it were, prepared him for this, at least in his past experiences. So he reacts the way he does. He puts dust on his head. He tears his clothes. He falls to the earth. He expresses this disappointment and lament in a very typical Israelite fashion. And he turns around and basically blames God for the events that have just transpired, as if it were God's fault that they were defeated by the people of Ai. So that takes us through verse 9. Let's see how God responds to him. So the Lord, verse 10, so the Lord said to Joshua, rise up. Why is it that you've fallen on your face? Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them, and they have taken some of the things under the ban and have both stolen and deceived. Moreover, they have also put them among their own things. Therefore, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies, for they have become accursed. That's literally, they become as harem. So it's that repetition of that word we've seen before. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy the things under the ban from your midst. Rise up, consecrate the people, and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, there are things under the ban in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you have removed the things under the ban from your midst. And then he goes on, in the morning, you shall come nearby your tribes, and it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes shall come nearby families, and the family which the Lord takes shall come nearby households, and the household which the Lord takes shall come near man by man. And it shall be that the one who is taken with the things under the ban shall be burned with fire, he and all that belongs to him, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord and because he has committed a disgraceful thing in Israel. So going back to verse 10, God's response to Joshua is basically, why are you doing what you're doing? Why have you fallen on your face? And why are you saying what you're saying? Because it's not as if I have somehow failed you. It's rather, we have this whole string of verbs here in verse 11. Israel has sinned, transgressed, taken, stolen, deceived, and put. So there's six verbs that God uses to describe what not just Achan, but Israel has done. So they've taken whatever it is. He doesn't spell it out. He just says they've taken some of the things that were part of the harem that were to be destroyed by fire. And not only have they taken them, but they have put them among their own things, as it says there. And God goes on in verse 12 to say that until this is dealt with, until those things are destroyed, then your enemies are going to continue to defeat you. And then he lays out for Joshua what he's supposed to do. So the people are to consecrate themselves, and then we're going to have this gradual narrowing down from tribe to family to household to man. And we're not told exactly how this is going to be done. Some of your translations will say in verse 14, it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes by lot. So it could be that that by lot is added. That's not in the original. But it could be that they were chosen by lot. It could be that they used the Urim and Thummim from the breastplate of the high priest to determine this, which were forms of lot too. We don't know exactly how this was done. Anyway, whatever method was used, that's how they narrowed it down from tribe to family to household to man. So that's what the Lord says is going to be the process by which they determine the guilty party. So what's going to happen? Well, verse 16 picks up from there and says basically that Joshua did exactly that. Joshua gets up early in the morning and he brings Israel nearby tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. And then he brings the family of Judah near, and the family of the Zerahites are taken. And then he brings the family of the Zerahites near man by man, and Zabdi was taken. Verse 18, he brought his household near man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah was taken. So just kind of trying to put myself into this situation. And I don't think you can read this without asking yourself what was going on with Achan during this whole narrowing down process.
Yeah, dude, I mean, or just any dude, can you imagine how like nerve-wracking, yeah, how nerve-wracking this whole ordeal is?
Yeah. Yes. I'm just in working with this story, thinking about it, preparing for it, I was just trying to put myself there. And the stress and the anxiety that must have been felt by everyone, yeah, especially if you're from the tribe of Judah.
Yeah, well, this takes a little while.
Yeah, this isn't just like 5 minutes later and, here we have the culprit.
But did you start to wonder, you're like, did I do anything? I mean, yeah, can I just imagine you're sitting there auditing like the entire Jericho event and you're like, did I do anything?
Yeah. You check in your pockets.
Yeah. Just trying to figure out, like, is there something I was supposed to do that I didn't do? But especially as it got narrowed, if you're still, you know, you're still in that bunch, you know, three steps down the process, and you're like, oh, man.
It's not quite the same, but it's almost like on the night that Jesus was betrayed, and all the disciples are wondering who it's going to be, right?
Yeah.
Is it I, Lord? And ironically, or perhaps not so ironically, it ends up being Judas, whose name is a Hellenized form of Judah, and Judah ends up being the tribe from which Achan comes as well.
Well, a lot of bad things come from Judah, and then one good thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's pretty much a good description of that tribe. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose Achan was being a typical sinner here. And even though I'm sure he was sweating more and more as it narrowed down more and more, probably at first he thought, looking around, like, you know, there are a whole lot of Israelites here. I mean, what are the chances that I'm the only one who took something? I mean, there had to have been somebody else. I couldn't be the only one that found something that was valuable and put it in my backpack when we left the city. There had to have been somebody else. So probably I'm thinking at first, yeah, he would have been nervous, but he was probably thinking, yeah, it's gotta be somebody else. But then of course, as it narrows down more and more, he comes to the point where he realizes it's going to be him. And yet, interestingly, he never does step forth and claim responsibility until the finger is pointed directly at him.
If you know that you did this thing and you're letting this process play out, either you're hoping that it doesn't fall on you and you'll get away with it, mm-hmm. or that maybe God will be mistaken and someone else will take the fall, which of course is just horrific.
Yeah.
Like the repentant thing to do is to step forward. And also maybe your only shot.
Yeah. Yeah. Might be the only shot that you have is to actually to step forward and to confess what you've done before everybody else is excluded except you.
If you come forward, plead with God for mercy, well, there's not a lot of times in Scripture where God doesn't grant it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But his confession comes only after...
Right.
Only at the end. I mean, there are no more... There's no more options at that point. So, well, let's see what happens. This is picking up with verse 19. Joshua said to Achan, "My son," which is an interesting way to begin, right? I mean, this is kind of a very paternal, a lot more compassionate address than I would have expected given the situation. But Joshua says to Achan, "My son, I implore you, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give praise to him, and tell me now what you have done. Do not hide it from me." So Achan answered Joshua and said, "Truly, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar," and which is kind of a general name for Mesopotamia, "from Shinar, and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold, 50 shekels in weight, then I coveted them and took them. And behold, they are concealed in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath it." So Joshua sends messengers and they ran to the tent, and behold, it was concealed in his tent with the silver underneath it. And they took them from inside the tent and brought them to Joshua and to all the sons of Israel, and they poured them out before the Lord. Then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that belonged to him. And he brought them up to the valley of Achor. I'll go ahead and finish it out. There's two verses left. And Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned him with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And they raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day. And the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor, or the Valley of Trouble, to this day. So it's a pretty fascinating account. And there's some ambiguity here, too. I was trying to figure out exactly who all was punished this morning. And the truth is that I don't think that we can actually say with anything approximating complete confidence, because it's ambiguous. The language goes back and forth between singular and plural. You notice they bring everything out, right? They bring not only this Achan, but all of the stuff he stole, and his doesn't mention his wife. Maybe he was a widower. But she's never mentioned. But his children, his sons and daughters, and his animals, they bring everything out to the valley of Achor. And then it says, verse 25, all Israel stoned him with stones. But then it goes on to say, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. But then it goes back to the singular in verse 26 and says, and they raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day. So it's a little unclear. And what's unclear is whether it was only Achan and his material possessions and animals that were destroyed, and then, you know, this heap was built up around them, or did, as we have in other cases in the Old Testament, did Achan's family also suffer the death penalty along with him? I think the best that we can say is we're not sure, because I think there is that ambiguity that's kind of built into the story. The main point, of course, is that Achan himself is the one who brought trouble upon Israel, and so trouble was brought upon him. Now, he did confess, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and if the situation had been different, if it hadn't been like down just to him alone, if he'd have stepped forward at the beginning and said, "Truly, I have sinned against the Lord, and here's what I did," then yeah, there's a chance, chances are this would have gone very differently.
Yeah.
Because his confession, I mean, as it stands, he doesn't make excuses, right?
No, it's a good confession. I mean, he doesn't even say, "Yeah, I took the stuff." He even confesses the root of the sin, which is that I saw it and I coveted it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not just the act, but he's saying covetousness took hold of my heart and I did this thing. And I mean, it's the language that Joshua uses is this, you've brought trouble on us. Now the Lord's going to bring trouble on you. And you're like, good grief, dude. That is, you are not lying.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all out law there. That's for sure.
I think you're right. Like you can't know for sure. But as I read this, it does seem that they stone him and then they burn everything with fire. I do think there's at least reason to have pause and say, what are they burning here? What's going on? And it seems that it's at least within the realm of possibility that this is all his possessions, that in taking that stuff, they burn up everything. And so kind of everything that this stuff has touched is tainted. And you see that's consistent with other things in the Old Testament, that this stuff was buried underneath his tent, and they just take all his stuff, and all of it gets torched. I mean, sort of everything that this unholy item has come in contact with, which there's reason to think does not include his family. They may not have even known about it.
Yeah, it's one of the grim stories that we have from early in the life of Israel. And we got a couple minutes left. I want to bring this in before we run out of time on how this sad, troublesome, literally troublesome story is taken up by Hosea and turned around. So this is from Hosea chapter 2, beginning with verse 14. I'll just read a couple of verses. This is God speaking, and he's talking about what he's going to do for Israel in the days of the Messiah. He says, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her," literally to speak to her heart. So this is, God is talking about the future days, and he's going to bring Israel back into the wilderness, and he's going to court her, as it will. He's going to make her fall in love with him again by speaking to her heart. Israel has just entered the Holy Land of Joshua, but in Hosea, he's talking about taking them back out into the wilderness for a second entrance, a re-entrance into the promised land. But notice the language he uses next. "Then I will give her vineyards from there and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt." So this is a perfect example of how the prophets will take something from early in the life of Israel, and they'll use it to talk about what's going to happen in the days of the Messiah, but will illustrate how everything's going to be turned around. So there'll be a second exodus, a second entrance. And instead of there being this valley of trouble that was marked by rebellion and sin and death, it's going to be marked by hope and by a restoration that's going to be brought about by the work of the Messiah. So when Christ comes, we no longer have this place of trouble. Instead, we have this doorway of hope. And instead of you having Achan punished, and you have Christ who's taken the punishment upon himself and transforming this new exodus into a doorway of hope for the church.
What's interesting is that how often 30 minutes in the New Testament and 40 minutes in the Old Testament overlap. I mean, so as I record these episodes, and it's not intentional, but sometimes if someone listens to both, they might think that we have things coordinated, but this is not the case. It's just that they overlap everywhere. We just talked about this in 30 minutes in the New Testament, where Zechariah gives his prophecy over John, and he talks about him being the one who will prepare the way of the Lord and will give knowledge of redemption that is through the forgiveness of sins, right? Mm-hmm. Now, John does this by the Jordan in the wilderness. And this is exactly what, as Hosea talks about this. I mean, it's interesting that he goes outside and says that the true promise is coming. If we think about John as this fiery repentance figure, and he is certainly that, but his job is to prepare the way, is to speak to the people, and as Zechariah says, to tell them about redemption that is contained not in anything other than the forgiveness of their sins. This is why he is baptizing people that would think they have no need to be baptized. And so it's so interesting how we'll be over here in Joshua talking about this stuff, and then we'll be over in Luke talking about this other stuff, and it's all connected. This is where this ultimately happens, where God puts his word in the mouth of John and says, the salvation is coming.
It's amazing to me how all of these things intersect in one way or another. I mean, the Exodus, the Jordan, John, redemption, Achan, they're all pulled together from a lot of different directions, and they all coalesce in the work of the Messiah.
Yeah.
And we didn't even plan it.
No, and there's no planning. It's just, it's just always there, man. It's just always there. Yeah. So that is it. Guys, if the podcast has been helpful to you and you'd like to support the work of this and everything else that we do, you can go over to 1517.org, go to the donate page, and you can become a supporter. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Check out the live stream. Chad, by the time this airs, we'll be hanging out.
That's right. See you in a couple days.